Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
There have been times when Korea has lived in some tranquility, but there have also been times, such as now, when it seems to have an outsized influence on global affairs, certainly in the case of North Korea, bigger than its GDP figures would suggest it might have. With its nuclear capability and ruthless authoritarianism, North Korea has engaged Beijing and Washington at the highest levels. And the economic miracle in South Korea, as well as the history of democratic development there, have generated their own waves in global politics. So to think about Korea and its future, I'm joined by Eugene Park, who's recently written Korea: A History. So thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Owen.
And let's just go back. I think we should start. You go right back, but I'm going to sort of abbreviate the history, if that's all right, and start in 1900. And I just wonder if you can tell us, what was the state of Korea in 1900? What kind of a society was it? What kind of a political system? What was happening in 1900?
As of 1900, Korea had been maintaining independent, united monarchy for roughly a millennium, that is, since 936, prior to which the Korean Peninsula and the surrounding regions had been divided among smaller polities, or the states ruled by the direct ancestors of the present Korean population.
Right. So it was a traditional society, and, you know, it was in touch, it was aware of other societies around it, obviously, but nonetheless, it had for many, many centuries existed as its own polity, if you
yes,
like.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Now, presumably, it was very aware of the Chinese, you know, presence and size so near it. So what was the relationship with China at that time?
Yes, much throughout the book, I tried to provide a broader regional historical framework, especially in terms of the common misunderstandings, misperceptions, or cliches that are out there. And one such misperception is that the Asia, which really what most people seem to understand and think of it, hear the term Asia, is really East Asia. East Asia as such means China and Japan, pure and simple. But throughout the book, I maintain a framework according to which, at least until the late 19th century, China was the absolutely dominant center. That is one of a handful of a major continuing civilizations throughout the humanity's history. And on the periphery of China were various smaller actors, such as the ancestors of the Vietnamese, Koreans, Japanese, just to name a few, who selectively adopted the institutions and ideas from China.
Right. So China was an influence, but not one threatening Korean independence.
That is correct. Very different from the present contemporary, the perception, the West's perception of China as being overly aggressive, hostile, almost like some newbie, a new power just out of nowhere, without any sort of a historical justification, that is trying to claim some sort of a superpower status. But far from it, until the late 19th century, China, as a dominant civilization and a military force, was perfectly content to let neighboring groups maintain their autonomies and pursue their cultural development as long as they accepted China's the hegemony through various rituals.
Right. Tell us about those rituals then.
Mm-hmm. These rituals have changed much throughout history. And I think that the form that present-day Western audience or the readers that were more familiar with the region's history think of the most is a so-called a tributary system. That is, by the early modern era, by which I mean very roughly from about 1450 until 1850, the late imperial China's history featured the two dynasties, that is the Ming Dynasty and the Qing Dynasty. They were ethnically different. The Ming Dynasty was the last ethnically Han Chinese dynasty in Chinese history, whereas the Qing were the Manchus. But still, both the Ming and the Qing maintained a system according to which the emperor of China, the ruler of the Chinese Empire as a son of heaven, was the universal ruler. What that meant was that the tributaries, such as Vietnam, Laos, Burma, Korea, and in the case of Japan, very briefly in the 15th century, had to submit gifts, presents on certain special occasions, such as the new emperor's accession in China, or in the case of Japan, the new shogun taking his office, and certainly in the case of Korea, its new king ascending the throne. And such exchanges were highly ritualized with strict protocols. And accompanying each such tributary mission, whether we're talking going from a non-Chinese state to China or the other way around, was a heavy volume of officially licensed trade.
Right. Okay. Well, that describes the situation very well up until 1910. And then everything changed because Japan annexed Korea and Korea became part of the Japanese Empire. So what was the state of Japan at that time? Mm-hmm. And what was the run-up, as you like, to that Japanese annexation?
Yes. I think it would be a bit more useful if I were to take my response just a few decades further back, that is, let's say, mid-19th century. So certainly by then, China, Korea, Japan were all dealing with the threats of Western imperialism. In the case of China, it had already been defeated by Britain, among others, through such conflicts as the First Opium War. And both Korea and Japan were fully aware of what was transpiring in China. And also by the 1850s, there were increasingly numerous sightings of Western ships on the shores of Korea and Japan. But what made Japan unique, at least from the late 19th century until the end of the 20th century, was that, again, Japan successfully reinvented itself as the only non-Western nation that modeled itself after the imperialist Western powers. And in 1894, Japan successfully challenged China's traditional hegemony in the region by defeating China in the First Sino-Japanese War. And in 1904, 1905, Japan likewise succeeded, this time against a European-based state, the Russian Empire. Japan's victory over Russia in 1905 meant that by then, there was no major power standing in the way of or was willing to do anything about Japan taking over Korea. And indeed, later in 1905, after defeating Russia, Japan, in full military occupation of the Korean Peninsula, turned Korea into a protectorate, which essentially meant that Japan stripped Korea of international diplomatic representation. And 5 years later, in 1910, Japan officially, formally annexed Korea, thus turning Korea into a Japanese colony.
And tell us about the nature of Japanese rule.
Yes, one of the many challenges, if not unique aspects of the Japanese colonial rule in Korea from 1910 to 1945 was that Japan had taken over an immediate neighbor. That is not like Western nations that were acquiring and trying to govern colonies that are far away, right? Also, Korea, as Japan's new colony, had its own long history as a distinct culture and the autonomous state, with its recorded history going even further back than Japan's own. And so the main challenge for Japan then was how to not just maintain control using brute military force, but how to more fully integrate Korea into the expanding Japanese empire so that Japan could more successfully use Korea's resources, that is both the material and human. And of course, in life, it's always preferable to make one's population believe that they're in it for the enterprise for the common good, for the rather than forcing them to provide the goods and services.
And presumably, like any colony, there were Koreans who collaborated and there were Koreans who resisted.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, both the official, the public narrative, especially through education system in North and South Korea alike, and I think this is universal in most post-colonial or post-occupation societies, is that the good people or the patriots, those who cared about our nation, resisted, whereas the bad ones collaborated. But certainly so in real life, these were just the two extreme options, with a vast majority of the people just going about with their daily lives, if not struggling to survive, and they were in the middle.
Tell us then, if you look at it, you know, taking a step back, the Chinese influence up to 1910 and then the Japanese rule from 1910 to 1945, what were the differences in the influences on the Korean people from those two countries, China and Japan?
Very different. Until about 1882, when there was a military mutiny uprising in Korea, China was content to maintain more traditional ties with Korea, which meant that as long as Korea performed this ritual and diplomatic obligations as the Chinese Empire's tributary, China rarely meddled in the Korea's internal affairs. But from 1882 on, China became more aggressive in getting itself involved, sending troops, posting a viceroy, that is a resident general, to really look after and promote China's strategic interests, in part because by then, China's traditional tributaries in Southeast Asia had all been more or less taken over and were being controlled by Britain or France. And Japan by then was increasingly encroaching upon Korea. And of course, Japan's victory over China through the First Sino-Japanese War of 1894-1895 meant that certainly in terms of China's military presence and China's claim to special influence or control over Korea, all of those things came to an end. In contrast to China's approach, Japan decided right from the beginning to maintain direct control of Korea by doing at least two things. One is the setting up a very large bureaucracy, very much larger than comparable colonial bureaucracy in the French Indochina, for example, or the British possessions at the time. And secondly, Japan maintained a strong, formidable military presence on the Korean Peninsula, which ultimately became Japan's base for its further expansion into the continental Asia, including Manchukuo and the China proper in the 1930s.
So that explains it in terms of imperial policy, if you like, almost military policy, political influence. But what about cultural influences? What were the differences there?
Japan's policy, cultural policy vis-a-vis Korea as a colony, shifted initially from 1910 to 1919, when there was a massive colony-wise uprising, anti-Japanese uprising. Japan used more heavy-handed approach. For instance, that there was a complete, almost total press blackout, strict censorship. But in 1919, Colonial Korea is an uprising, made the Japanese authorities realize they have to take a slightly different approach. What followed was something called the cultural policy, or also known as the Enlightened Administration, with which the Japanese Empire made a certain relatively minor concessions toward Koreans. So, for example, now Japan was allowing Korean language publications, which, of course, they were all subjected to pre-publication censorship. There was the Japan allowed the limited right to assemble, and also the low level of local autonomy. And from 1919 until the beginning of the war in Northeast Asia, that is the Second Sino-Japanese War from 1937 to 1945, Japan essentially promised to the Koreans, as Japan's colonial subject, promised them that once you, meaning Koreans, all can prove that you are worthy of becoming full-fledged citizens in the civilized world, then we may grant you, Koreans, greater autonomy, if not independence, with that once or when never fully specified.
And I was also thinking in terms of, I don't know, religious influence, intellectual influence. What were the differences there?
Traditionally, dominant religions or belief systems in Korea were the indigenous popular religion, also known as a shamanism. All the scholars disagree on whether on the definition of shamanism, but I'll just call it shamanism here. And as I do in my book, shamanism, Buddhism, and Confucianism, and any combination thereof. Whereas in Japan, traditionally Shinto, which in many ways we could think of as Japan's uniquely institutionalized version of its own ancient shamanism. So Shinto and the Buddhism. And whereas Confucianism, the influence of Confucianism in Japan was by far the weakest among any of the East Asian or Northeast Asian countries. So there certainly was much common ground, religious common ground, between the colonizer Japan and the colonized Korea. And of course, what this meant was that the colonizer looked for every opportunity to co-opt colonial Korea's religious leaders, usually through setting up a collaborationist or the pro-Japanese wing or Korean group within the Koreans, among Koreans, but practicing that particular religion, let's say a particular lineage of Buddhism, for example.
Let's pull forward to the Second World War, because that's the next big change, really. And Japan obviously defeated in the Second World War and lost its Korean colony. And so we should move forward to 1945 and what happened at that time.
Japan mobilized Korea and other colonies as fully as it could for the Second Sino-Japanese War, which eventually merged with the World War II when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941. About 2 weeks before Japan's official surrender of August 15th, 1945, the United States had become increasingly alarmed by the real likely prospect of the Soviet Union occupying a big chunk of the Japanese empire that was rapidly collapsing. Because going back a few months in May 1945, Nazi Germany has surrendered. And since then, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's successor, Truman, had been watching and hearing with a growing sense of anger about how the Soviets were setting up pro-Soviet communist governments in Eastern Europe. As Stalin had promised earlier to Franklin Delano Roosevelt in August, Soviet Union finally officially declared war against Japan. And while the Americans were fighting one bloody battle after another, island by island in the Southeast Asia, over a million Soviet troops were making their way down, rushing through the Japanese collaborationist state of Manchukuo and the Korean Peninsula, even making amphibious landings. Almost out of desperation, figuring that there was little to lose, in August 1945, the U.S. proposed to the Soviets that the two powers divide Korea roughly evenly with or along the 38th parallel. And to America's surprise, Soviet Union basically said, okay, let's divide Korea, even though Soviet Union was in was militarily capable of occupying the entire Korean peninsula. After August 15th, it took about three more weeks for the Americans to even arrive in Korea.
So it is one of the things that I think is misunderstood, certainly I'm afraid, including by me, before I read your book, that the division of Korea didn't arise because of the Korean War. It existed before, and then the conflict came.
Yes, it was a division, unfortunately and tragically, was according to decision made by the U.S. government on the eve of Japan's formal surrender. And so it was a very much so a self-serving strategic decision on the part of Americans. Of course, needless to say, no Korean was consulted.
And why then was there a conflict? Because the two big superpowers had done their deal. They'd arranged the 38th parallel as the dividing line. What need for conflict after that?
Mm-hmm. The conflict on the Korean Peninsula was very much a child of the expanding Cold War between the two erstwhile allies, that is the Soviet Union and the United States. Certainly by 1946-47, the relations had soured between the two powers. And also their initial agreement or commitment to setting up a united Korean government through their respective clients or the protege lead, political groups in both Northern Korea and Southern Korea absolutely failed. So definitely by 1947, the almost other than those were those Koreans were fervently nationalistic and who wanted united Korea and regardless, no matter what, the politics among Koreans themselves had become hopelessly polarized. And what resulted in 1948 were the inauguration or the establishments of two rival, mutually hostile governments on the Korean Peninsula.
And then conflict.
Yes.
So tell us about the Korean War. You know, can you describe the main events of that conflict and how it ended?
Yes. So South Korea being supported by the United States and North Korea being supported by the Soviet Union, both North and South Korean leaders were outspoken and made no secret of the fact that they each wanted to reunify Korea by using force if necessary. By the eve of the outbreak of the Korean War in June 1950, the developments, both the internal and the external, were highly favorable to North Korea, where they were highly unfavorable for South Korea. In the case of South Korea, by 1948 or 49, roughly by then, United States had more or less given, sent signals to the world that in the Far East or East Asia, U.S. was only committed to, fully committed to defending Japan in the outbreak of some sort of communist aggression, whereas both South Korea and Taiwan, the nationalist government as Taiwan, were beyond America's defensive perimeter. At least that was the common perception in the world at the time. And America's military support for South Korea at the time, in terms of actual ground personnel and the equipment, were minimal. Whereas in stark contrast, North Korea continued to receive tanks and other forms of heavy armament from the Soviet Union, and also the newly victorious communist government of China under Mao Zedong released more than 100,000 Korean communists who had been fighting alongside the Chinese communists during the Chinese Civil War. So these are the battle-hardened, the combat veterans. And also, just to add one more factor, when the founding leader of North Korea began his administration began in 1948, by then, more than a million Northern Koreans who did not want to live under communist rule for various reasons, that they fled south, and in many ways making it easier for Kim Il-sung to control Korea with so many dissenters gone. Whereas in Southern Korea, the violent civil war persists as the leftists in Southern South Korea continue to resist the Southern authorities and also the America's influence. So the North Korea's Kim Il-sung in June 1950 ultimately decided to launch an all-out invasion, confident that in just a matter of weeks, he'll be able to conquer South Korea.
But it didn't work out like that. And so can you just tell us why it was that Korea remained divided at the end of the conflict, just as it began it?
Mm-hmm. By then, Truman administration had come to conclude that Soviet Union's ambitions in the Far East extended beyond communist North Korea, that Stalin was even willing to make additional gains by supporting North Korea and ultimately conquering South Korea. So by then, the United States decided that it wasn't enough to just defend Japan militarily and rebuild Japan economically, but the United States must defend South Korea as well as Taiwan against any sort of communist aggression. In the matter of the first several weeks during the war, United States and sent massive, sizable reinforcements to South Korea, to the extent where in September 1950, under General Douglas MacArthur's command, the UN forces, most of which were the Americans, made a successful amphibious landing at Incheon near Seoul that turned the tide of the war in favor of the UN troops and pushed the battlefront closer to the Sino-North Korean border. But at that critical juncture in the October or November of 1950, China militarily intervened. And so with China's support, then the North Koreans were able to push the South Korean UN troops back southward, even further south beyond the 38th parallel, until the battlefront finally stabilized around what is now the DMZ that divides the North and South Korea. And the stalemate set in by the spring of 1951, and the stalemate lasted a little over 2 years until July 1953, when all concerned parties had decided to just sit down and sign an armistice agreement, which is in effect to this day.
And the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, is that actually on the 38th parallel?
No, entirely different lines. 38th parallel is a straight latitudinal line, whereas the DMZ is a curvy line, which reflects how the battlefront was between North and South Korea as of July 1953.
So just for sort of to finish that off, who gained territory in that conflict?
Well, the South Korea gained slightly more. During that two-year stalemate, Southern forces were especially interested in gaining the central eastern part of Korea with lots of the minerals, the mining potential, whereas the North Koreans were especially keen on making as much gain as possible closer to Seoul in the western, in the west coast of the Korean Peninsula.
So that takes us to the era which, journalists like I who've been covering events for the last few decades are much more familiar with, the North Korea-South Korea divide and the extraordinary development of North Korea. Let's deal with North Korea first. And I mean, the story you've told of Chinese influence, Japanese colonization, and then the Americans and the Soviets sort of carving the country up would provide the explanation, would it not, of North Korea's idea about being self-reliant, which, you know, has driven them ever since.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So fundamentally, how North and South Korea are so different today in just about every aspect is a reflection of what the United States, on the one hand, and the Soviet Union and China, on the other hand, pursued for their respective, I guess, the Korean regimes that they supported. So in the case of South Korea, United States did what it was already committed to doing for Western Europe and Japan, that is, rebuild their economy so that there will be very little chance of socialism or revolutionary socialism or communism gaining popular support, as they continue to do so in more economically impoverished parts of the world. So by the 1960s, for the United States, the key move that it had to make in pursuing that aim for South Korea was to more fully integrate South Korea into the American-led defensive slash the economic bloc, with Japan as a junior partner and South Korea as a new junior partner. And in 1965, the United States was successful in goading and persuading Japan and South Korea to normalize their relations, that is, establishing formal diplomatic relations. Whereas in the case of North Korea, North Korea was doing just fine, as I explained a moment ago with regards to the Korean War, until the Soviet Union and China had a fallout. That is, after the death of Stalin, his successor Nikita Khrushchev in Soviet Union denounced Stalinism, and the China, for its own reasons, that Mao Zedong was pursuing more hardline communist policies, as reflected in such events as the Cultural Revolution. And in the 60s, there were even border clashes between the Soviet Union and the China. And the North Korea, needless to say, was caught in a very awkward position. And the Kim Il-sung pursued the policy of self-reliance, an important aspect of which was to make North Korea entirely independent politically, diplomatically, and also must be strong enough to defend itself, as well as achieving its own economic growth. But of course, the world by the second half of the 20th century, especially by the third quarter of the 20th century, was not the kind where a country can be entirely self-defendant. And definitely by in the 70s, North Korea's economy, economic growth has slowed down. And in the 80s, North Korea's economy stopped growing. And in the 90s, North Korea's economy actually began shrinking, in large part due to the devastating the failure with agriculture and also flooding and the famine.
So what started out as self-reliance and, you know, and a lot of Marxism-Leninism thrown in ended up as this disastrous situation which we see to this day of a totally impoverished population living under a very harsh dictatorship. And I just wonder now, is it, I mean, I guess the answer is pretty obvious, but the whole of North Korea's political future and political development depends on one family who are fighting for their lives, right? To stay in power, to protect themselves, and there's nothing more to it than that.
Absolutely. I forgot to mention that as long as both China and the Soviet Union, even if they're on the bad terms, as long as those two countries continue to do well in the 70s and 80s, North Korea was able to perform or pursue a very delicate diplomatic balancing act, going back and forth between the two powers. But once the Cold War ended, once the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc collapsed, then North Korea's options became even more limited. First of all, North Korea could no longer rely on the cheap crude oil for other material assistance from the Soviet Union and other pro-Soviet countries. And so North Korea, since the end of the Cold War, has been left with only China to look for such support.
Now, the political developments in the South were rather more interesting because there were military rulers there, and so you might have thought it would go along a similar path to North Korea, but it didn't. And there was a democratization movement which succeeded. So tell us about that and why. Yeah, who was in that movement? How much foreign involvement was there in it? How much was it an indigenous movement? And why did it succeed?
From the very beginning, 1948. South Korea at least got started. South Korea at least started off with a constitution that was very much committed to and fostered multi-party system. Of course, for decades, various authoritarian leaders that did not allow the spirit of a South Korea's constitution to fully come alive. But by 1988, there was no way, turning back for South Korea. South Korea was well on its way toward achieving one of the biggest, one of the most vibrant democracies in the world. Whereas North Korea's path has been very different in the sense that in 1948, the North Korean regime was established as a coalition of various competing and at times and before long mutually hostile communist factions. And by the end of the 60s, Kim Il-sung, the founding leader, had successfully eliminated or purged all remaining rival communist factions. As a way of concluding my explanation then, North Korea is what it is today because, yes, to many observers, can North Korea simply just mimic or imitate what China has been doing evidently successfully so since the 70s and 80s, right? That is a maintaining a one-party system while pursuing or allowing more liberalized economy, you know, geared toward the growth and allow capitalist enterprises. North Korea cannot do so, at least not fully, because North Korea is a state ruled by a particular family, a dynasty, if you will. The current leader, Kim Jong-un, is the third member of the family to rule North Korea. And pursuing a more open, liberalized, if not more capitalist economy would mean that before long, North Korea's population would become influenced by and would perhaps even demand greater political freedom with a pluralism.
Well, I mean, there are so many parallels with East and West Germany. And of course, yes. You know, whatever you say about the ideologies and the competition between those two countries, there was no movement of West Germans into East Germany. There was always East Germans trying to get into West Germany. And it's exactly the same in North and South Korea, with people trying to escape North Korea and some of them succeeding and ending up in the South. But I want to ask the question like this. Why is this too simplistic? Tell me that this is too simplistic, that the Korean Peninsula in the last 30, 40 years shows that capitalism just generates far more wealth and tolerance and in fosters democracy more than the communist system in the North.
Yes. Well, I'm afraid that I'm not much of an economic historian to really compare or contrast the merits of or the effectiveness of capitalism versus the socialism because, and also, well, certainly so in the case of the modern Korean history, we're looking at factors other than ideologies or economic policies that produce such a contrast between North and South Korea today. And as I've mentioned, some of these other factors include diplomatic and military policies of such actors as China, the Soviet Union, the United States. Also, other circumstances that I have not mentioned yet include, for example, the newly affluent or wealthy countries in the Middle East that by the 70s were almost desperately looking for cheap labor to build their infrastructure. And South Korea profited hugely from the various Middle Eastern construction projects from the 70s onward. Also, I forgot to mention, I should have mentioned, that in the same way, Japan's economy got a huge lift by supporting the United States as a regional base during the Korean War. Same thing happened for South Korea during the Vietnam War, during which in the 60s, South Korea not only committed troops to fight in Vietnam, in fact, becoming the second largest contributor of troops after the United States, fighting alongside the South Vietnamese, but South Korea economic growth received a huge boost from various projects that the South Korea secured, usually as the lowest bidders in South Vietnam.
So that's exactly. So there are lots of factors at play,
yes.
And we've ended up where we are. So you know, you've done a great job of summarizing very, very clearly a century's development of Korea's history. So we, as according to the title of the series, we need to look ahead. And I guess there are two questions: disarmament, nuclear disarmament, and reunification. So let me ask them in one. What are the prospects for reunification, and what are the prospects for nuclear disarmament?
Yes, these are, of course, $1 million questions. And I like to tell my students that the current situation is the one where the two sides are pointing guns at each other. And one is saying, you drop your gun and then I'll drop mine. And the other, no, you drop yours first and then I'll drop mine. So the reason I use that analogy is that North Korea wants absolute firm guarantee of the security for its regime. That is, North Korea wants a total firm promise that there will be no threat ever against the Kim dynasty. And what that means in more practical terms is a formal peace treaty to officially end the Korean War. Whereas certainly from the United States perspective, the peace treaty is not up for discussion before North Korea stops its saber rattling with its investment and the efforts toward the weapons of mass destruction, such as the long-distance ballistic missiles and the nuclear weapons.
Are the factors that lead to the stalemate now, you know, the failure to even think about reunification as a foreseeable prospect, can you see those factors changing? Is there any reason to believe reunification could happen?
Yes, in large part because if we just take a long-term perspective on the inter-Korean relations, since the 70s, the situation has improved incrementally with the ups and downs. That is, compared to, say, 20 years ago, the number of the incidents along the DMZ or the possibility of such an incident or actual have considerably decreased. And certainly from that perspective, slowly but surely, the situation is getting better. But can there ever be a secure framework that can guarantee a peaceful coexistence of a North and South Korea, respecting each other's system with absolutely no possibility of a conflict between the two? Can such a framework ever materialize? And at this point, I don't think it's going to happen, and certainly it's not going to happen in the next 2, 3, 4 years.
Sure, but that's very short term. I mean, but is it fair to say this, that there will never be reunification peacefully? Yeah, that if it happens, it will involve uprisings, military action, violence.
Yes. I think the one potential stimulus for such a scenario would be, say, the relatively young leader, the current leader, Kim Jong-un, were to die with no obvious the heir who was prepared to succeed. Reportedly, all of his the children, they're young, they're minors. That's one possibility. I think a lot also depends on what kind of administration we have in the United States and South Korea. So if both the American leadership and the South Korean leadership are committed to making certain concessions, for the lack of better words, so that the North Korea can relax a bit and that the North Korea is willing to back away, then that would certainly be progress. But at this point, we're stuck in a stalemate.
Well, thank you so much for explaining it to us, and it's a lot clearer now than it was, 45 minutes ago. So thanks very much.
Thank you, and my pleasure.